Let's try that. Good morning, everybody. All right, it's going to take me a second here to get going. I had a migraine this morning, and so I'm running a little behind where I want to be. And we're going to try to make this work. So give me 1 second to get up and running and figure out what the heck I'm doing. Get all my screens in the right places. Okay, it is Monday, April 13th. It is 9:05, 9:06 now. We're starting OCHEM Lab. And today we're doing infrared spectroscopy and boiling points. So this was a lab that we were supposed to do that included getting a chemical unknown, and there was a large list of possible unknowns that you could have been given. So I think there's a list of about 50 different unknowns, all different functional groups, all different types of compounds, and all liquids. And you were requested to take the boiling point of the compound. And when you took the boiling point and you looked at the table, unlike some of the other labs that we did, the boiling point didn't allow you to figure out the compound by itself. The boiling point, what it did was give you a range of compounds between 5 to 7 different compounds that all had the same boiling points. And then you needed to take the infrared spectroscopy of that compound. And when you took the infrared spectroscopy, it would nail it down to a functional group. So you would figure out whether your compound was an aldehyde or a ketone or an ester or a carboxylic acid, an alkene, all the different functional groups. And then you go back to that list, and now you have maybe 2 or 3 options of compounds that are on that list. And then you actually look up the spectra for those compounds and figure out what compound yours is by matching the spectrum. The infrared spectrum is like a fingerprint. It tells you not only what functional groups are in the molecule, but each molecule has its own very specific individual infrared spectrum. And so it is just much like a fingerprint that tells you what the compound actually is. So when you match up the spectrum and you get a spectrum match, you can tell definitively what the compound is. The hard parts for the lab today were figuring out how to take the boiling point. Turns out that the boiling point is not an easy thing to actually do. And so there's some trial and error in learning how to do boiling points. And then learning how to read infrared spectroscopy, but not just how to read it, but also how to conduct it, how to do it. And that was learning how to use our specific infrared spectrophotometer and the processes that we have in place to be able to take infrared spectrum. And that is actually fairly easy. It's just a lengthy thing to teach you because we have to teach you not only the theory behind infrared spectroscopy, how spectroscopy actually works with the molecule and the interaction of light, what regions to read and to look at in terms of infrared spectroscopy, but then also how to conduct it and how to run our software and how to clean the sodium chloride plates and all of that. So there was a lot that was involved in today's lab lecture, and it was actually quite a lengthy lab lecture. I don't know how long this lab lecture is going to be. I think I'm going to try to do similar things in telling you how to run boiling points and what they look like. And fortunately, I have a video to show you of me actually conducting a boiling point, so that makes it a little bit easier to visualize and see. The infrared spectroscopy we're not going to explain how the software actually works, but we will explain to some degree how the instrument works and how the theory works and go into all of that. So that's sort of the plan for today. Let me check in with people and see how everybody's doing, see that everything's working all right so far and that you guys are all with me. Are we doing okay this morning? Thumbs ups. All right. There's a few. Cool. Okay. Any questions before I get rolling this morning? And I think we'll deal with boiling point first because that's the shortest, easiest thing to do. And I can show you how boiling points work. I'll give you a chance to ask questions first before we get rolling. All right. And everything on my end is working okay. I've got a new webcam up. So I was able to actually get a new webcam, and so it's not killing my phone anymore. And I think it's looking pretty much like my phone did. It's looking pretty good. But as long as everything's working, all right, let's give it a shot and let's see if we can talk boiling points this morning. I'm going to switch out glasses so I can look down at my iPad rather than at my screen. Okay, so boiling points, much like melting points, tell us a lot about what the compound is, that every compound has its own very specific boiling point, and the boiling points are a sharp number, unlike melting points, where while the material is melting, the temperature continues to ramp up. Boiling points are taken a little bit differently, and it's a sharp number, a single number, so there's not a range within a boiling point. The problem is the way that boiling points are usually done. Okay, we are recording, we're back on. So we're starting off with, this is, what is it, lab 7? I forgot what lab it actually is. It's either 7 or 8. 7 was simple and fractional, so this is lab 8. Boiling point and FTIR. Okay, so looking at boiling points and how they differ from melting points, that when we had a capillary tube and we had the sample down in the bottom of the capillary tube, the heat graph, that as we were heating, heating was following that curve. And we tried, so this was time, and this was temp. And we tried to take our melting point sort of out here where the curve was stabilizing. But still, the temperature was increasing and changing. And so we had that onset point, and then we had the clear point. And if we think about onset and clear, that the temperature continued to increase during that time. And so what we had is we had a range. I guess the better way to actually indicate the range is to say that this was our melting point range, which equaled the onset to the clear point. In a boiling point, what's happening is the boiling point is the boiling point is where the pressure of the vapor is equal to the pressure of the atmosphere. And so we just need to find a way of visually seeing that boiling or measuring the vapor pressure when it is equal to the atmospheric pressure, and that's what our boiling point is. And so it's a sharp point rather than a range. How boiling points used to be done is we used to use a piece of equipment that looked kind of like this. And this was an oil-filled device. And you would take a sample and put the sample inside here. And it would be a slightly bigger test tube than these capillary tubes that we use. And we would heat the sample up from the side. And we would also have a thermometer that would be in here. So I got to sneak a thermometer in here somehow. It's a horrible thermometer, I apologize. But we would then kind of hook these two together, strap these two together, and we would heat this thing up and we would watch to see when the material actually boiled. And we would do that on a slightly larger scale. The other way that you could do it is you could just take a large beaker or Erlenmeyer of the material and put some boiling stones in it and put it on a hot plate and just crank it up and watch and see when it boils. That's the other possibility. But each of these possibilities use a large amount of the material. And because these materials are hazardous and because their vapors are hazardous, trying to do boiling points on a large scale like this is really not feasible, not practical within our laboratory experiments. So what we do is we use the same capillary tube. So these are too large in scale. We use the same capillary tube that we used before in our melt temps. And we put that into, I'm not gonna draw a melt temp device, you guys know what those look like, but we use the capillary tube plus the melt temp, and we just put a small amount of liquid inside of this, and we put it in the melt temp. The problem is that when you put it in the melt temp, in a capillary tube, boiling doesn't occur in the same way, and there's no way to get little boiling stones in there to try to see boiling with boiling stones. So boiling stones aren't gonna work. But what we can do is use a small trick where we take another capillary tube and put a capillary tube inside of the already small capillary tube. We pull out and we leave this bottom end open and we close the top. So the bottom end down here is open. The top end is closed. And putting that capillary tube inside there is going to allow us to actually see when the boiling point occurs. What's going to happen is that we're going to heat this tube up, and that inner tube, we call it a dumbbell for lack of a better term, the dumbbell is going to allow gases to expand out of it. And as air expands out, you're going to see first air sort of bubbles come out of this thing. And then once air stops coming out of it, it acts like a boiling stick sitting inside the liquid. And eventually when the liquid cools down, it's going to go back up inside that tube. And we're gonna talk about the pressures and how that's actually working. So let me show you, not zoom in so much, and let's talk about what happens when we heat a capillary tube like this. All right, so we'll draw a larger capillary tube. And we'll put the small capillary tube inside this. And it goes down close to the bottom. And this end is open. And this extends up. So, this isn't the bottom of the tube, and someplace up here, this tube's closed off. And we put liquid down inside this guy, and then we heat it in the melt temp. And what we originally see is that there is air inside this tube as we start to heat it. And as you start to heat it, air expands. And as the air expands, what happens is bubbles of air, circular bubbles of air come out of this, and erupt out of the solution. So as we start to heat, the air expands and forms bubbles. And we'll say slow bubbles. Let's just copy this much. We'll throw it in there. And actually, I want these bubbles out. Okay, so the air expands and bubbles come out. Eventually what happens is all of the air leaves that little capillary tube. So with continued heating, the air is now gone. And what we actually start to see is we actually start to see bubbling. We actually start to see boiling. So we'll paste this in again. So now air is gone, and this thing has pressure of the gas inside it that is the gas of whatever liquid it is that we're examining. So the air has been purged out of that, and the air is completely gone. And now what we actually start to see is we actually start to see rapid boiling. We start to see very fast bubbles coming out of this thing, and they're all moving out of this. And so this is actual boiling that is happening. And this is fast bubbles. And it's a rate thing. How to tell when the air has purged and when you actually see boiling is about the speed and the rate of the bubbles that are coming out of this thing. And it's a very fine line to know when all the air is out and when the boiling actually starts. And you can't actually discern between the two. All you can know is when you are actually boiling versus when air might have been coming out. And the question is, well, how do I know when, what the boiling point is then? How do I gauge on the thermometer? When do I take the boiling point? Well, what we do is one more step. We cool this down. And as you cool down, the right now, if we were to look at things, we would say that the pressure of the vapor is less than the pressure of the atmosphere. We're still in pressure of the vapor less than the pressure of the atmosphere. Over here, we're at pressure of the vapor is greater than the pressure of the atmosphere. And what we're trying to find is where the pressure is equal. So as we cool the system down, what happens is the two pressures become equal, and as they become equal, they flip. And the pressure of the vapor starts to become less than the pressure of the gas. And at that point, the bubbling stops, and the liquid takes a turn, and the liquid starts to travel back up inside this capillary tube. So there's no more bubbles. And the liquid turns because the pressure of the vapor has now just become equal to the pressure of the gas, pressure of the atmosphere. And so what's happening is pushing down on this is the pressure of the atmosphere. Pushing down from the other side is the pressure of the vapor. And as that liquid takes a turn and the liquid starts to go up into the capillary tube, that's where the vapor pressures were instantaneously equal as they're transitioning, going back to, so momentarily we got pressure vapor is equal to pressure of the gas atmosphere. And very quickly it transitions to the pressure of the vapor back to being less than the pressure of the atmosphere. And that instantaneous moment where the liquid starts to go back up into the tube, that is the boiling point. That's where we read the boiling point. And it's tricky in that when we're trying to take that boiling point, first off, just getting the liquid inside the capillary tube is non-trivial. It's challenging to get a few drops of liquid to go down inside that capillary tube. The second thing is to draw a smaller capillary tube to fit inside the first capillary tube is also not trivial. So we've got a couple of boiling points tend to be very challenging to learn how to do, despite how simple the process actually is. Okay, so a couple of things. Number one, loading liquid into melt temp tube. In order to do that, what we tend to do is take a pipette that was pulled out for doing TLC. And so at the ends of those pipettes, we have these extreme tiny capillary tubes. So this was a really tiny capillary tube. Come on. My line got off there. I want to keep my line really tiny. There we go. So this was a pulled out pipette end. And then from there, what we do is we take that pulled out pipette end and we dip it into whatever sample solution it is that we want to take the boiling point of and that we want to move liquid into. So from here, what we did is we gave you guys little sample vials, and the sample vials had a couple of mils of liquid in it. And we just dip it down in there and it will suck up the solution. So if the solution is here, it will draw the solution up into the pipette by a certain height. And then what we do is we take that pipette and you put that pipette into the capillary tube all the way at the bottom. And we don't use a pipette bulb. It just does all of this by capillary action. So now we insert this into the Meltemp capillary tube. And usually we keep it long enough that it gets all the way down near the bottom. And then what I do is I apply just a little bit of thumb pressure. So if we imagine sort of a thumbnail here and your thumb applying pressure to this, and you just push down on it with your thumb. And as you push down on it with your thumb, what winds up happening is it expresses the liquid by your thumb actually going into the little soft bit of your thumb, pushing into the pipette. It applies a force to the pipette and it actually causes liquid droplets to come out. And so this material expresses out into the capillary tube. And then with just a little bit of tapping, you can get those to settle down into the bottom of the capillary tube. So that's how we go about and do that. And it takes a little bit of practice, but it's not that hard. It works. So we get a little bit of liquid down in here. Okay, so that's loading the capillary tube. Number two, making the dumbbell. So to make the dumbbell, in making the dumbbell, what we do is we take a pipette and we draw out a pipette the same way that we would to be able to do TLC. So we take the flame and we pull this thing out and we get that really fine tube. So now we've got our drawn out very fine little capillary tube. And then it kind of ballooned out on this end and ballooned out on this end. We break that tube and take a piece of that tube. And then within the Bunsen burner, what we do is we take that edge of that Bunsen burner. We have slightly bigger Bunsen burners. And so we've got the flame that's on this guy. Actually, I guess down at the bottom near that flame, it's kind of blue, huh? All right. And then we take that capillary tube and put it into the flame just on the very corner. And what you do is you rotate it just at the edge of the flame, just where it kisses the flame and it starts to make a little bit of yellow color that comes off of this. So you'll see a little bit of yellow flame as you stick it into the flame. And then what happens is the tube actually seals up and makes a little ball on the end of the tube. And so if we could blow that tube up and look at what's actually happening there, the tube glass kind of melts together and it makes a little ball on the end of the tube. And that little ball generally gets a fairly thick bit of glass that's on it and the tube seals up. I got the wrong eraser with the whole eraser. There we go. And then we take and we put that sealed tube with the sealed side up down into the capillary tube. And as far as how big you want the dumbbell, I like the dumbbell to be about twice as tall as the amount of liquid that's about to go into the tube. So now number three, we load the dumbbell. And so we take our capillary tube And ideally, if the liquid inside the tube is about this high, then I like the dumbbell to be sitting in there to be about twice as high. And what helps is the more narrow the dumbbell is, and again, this is my open end, nope, closed end and opened end down at the bottom. So this is closed and open. And for height, I like this to be about 2 times the liquid height. And as small as possible, as thin as possible. Particularly with more viscous liquids, the thinner the capillary tube you can get in there, the better this is actually going to work. And that 2 times the liquid of the height is really to give the tube a little bit of mass, because otherwise it turns into a little tiny rocket ship as the boiling starts and air bubbles start coming at it. And it just jettisons itself up right out of view if you don't make it tall enough and give it enough mass to be able to stick down in the bottom of that. And then we just put it into a melt temp and we do essentially the same thing that we did before. We heat it up until we see the bubbles coming out. We turn down the melt temp, leave the light on, cool it down. We watch to see when the bubbles stop and when the liquid goes back up into the tube. And then that's our boiling point. So let me see if I can show you a video. Oh, I think I actually have it on the iPad. I moved it over here last night in anticipation of needing it. So we'll go to my photographs, go to the boiling point. And so this video is playing. I think I can zoom in on it a little bit here. And what you're seeing there is on the left-hand side, you have the little piece of metal that is the temperature sensor inside the melt-in. And then in the center of the screen, you can see the little capillary tube inside the melt-in tube. You can't see the top of the liquid because the top of the liquid is out of the screenshot. But right now, what you're seeing is just air coming out of this thing. And so the melt temp is heating up fairly quickly, and we're seeing air come out. And when it transitions from being air to boiling, it's hard to discern. It's just a matter of watching it until it goes fast enough, until we deem it being fast enough that we decide that it's time to turn down the temperature on the melt temp. And that's just a rate call. So what I would say is right about now, we're reaching the point where probably most of the air has come out of the small capillary tube. And we're reaching the point where we're probably boiling. But I'm going to push it a little bit harder. And I'm going to keep heating this thing up until I see significant boiling. Now, the only risk here is that sometimes you can overheat it and you can boil away all of your liquid. So you don't want to do that. You want to start cooling it before then. Now I would say we're definitely boiling. So you can see the rate difference in how fast the bubbles are starting to come out of this. And they're changing in that I'm getting little bursts of bubbles rather than just a constant stream. And every liquid is different. Every liquid does something unique. So that now I'm boiling and I'm probably already cooling the tube. I would have already turned it down and started to wait for it to actually cool. And so now it's just a matter of watching and waiting until the boiling actually stops and the liquid takes a turn and it's thinking about it. It's trying to go back inside the little capillary tube. So we're getting little pressure differentials, but eventually that boiling is going to stop. And what we're going to see is the liquid will just very slowly start to turn and go back up. There it is right there. So that was the last bubbles, and the liquid is starting to go back up into the tube, and I would record the boiling point now. And that would be our boiling point. That's the whole process for taking boiling points. Whole lot simpler electronically like this, digitally, and seeing it run. Any questions on kind of what happened there?
Was the, near the end, was the tube jumping up and down because it was trying to, the liquid was trying to force itself back into it?
I don't think the tube was actually jumping up and down. Let me run it to the end of that. Let's see. Let me play and see if I can run it to the end of that video. No. Oh, come on. Okay, so how to make it do what I want. Oh, there we go. It looks like the tube is jumping up and down. Okay, I see what you're saying. The tube is not jumping up and down. That's the liquid inside the tube moving up and down. So the tube is not changing position at all. So that's actually a good question to answer. The tube is locked in place. It is the liquid that is moving up into the tube that you're seeing the meniscus move. So it was the meniscus that was jumping up and down, Francisco, and not the actual tube jumping up and down. If I had a pointer on here, which I don't think I can get, but maybe what I can do is copy an image. I could screenshot it and take that screenshot and copy it and move it into Notability and add it to the note. If I take this over into Notability, then what we're seeing here is right on the edges, this is the inner capillary tube, the walls of that inner capillary tube, and they go all the way down and extend down to the bottom of the capillary tube, which is down there. And so what you actually saw was the meniscus jumping up and down, not the actual tube moving itself. That tube stayed sort of locked in place, and we actually just watched the liquid jump up and down, the liquid level, the meniscus jump up and down inside the tube. So that's what was actually taking place there.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. Any other questions? Anybody else have questions about how that boiling point is taken?
Yes. So I just have a question. How do you cool it down?
You cool it down. Okay. So on the melt temp, our melt temps have our controller, the dial on the right-hand side, and we have that round light source that shines on the mirrored piece, and there's that piece, and then the actual piece where the tube goes down. That kind of fits into here, and there's a spot for the thermometer to hook to and the heating apparatus. And then we have the shrouding on it. I'm not drawing the shrouding all in place, but you're generally looking down this part here, and the tubes sit inside of that area in that range there. And this is our controller that has the difference between 0 and 100 or 0 and 10. I guess it's 0 and 10. To cool it down, what we do is we simply just turn the dial down. So there's that also that little rocker switch, and the rocker switch turns the light on and off. I leave the light on. I don't mess with the rocker switch. Basically, what I do is I just turn the dial down maybe 20 units or maybe 2 units because it's 1 through 10. I turn the dial down enough that the instrument starts to cool down without turning the light off so that I can actually see what's going on inside of it. So let's say that originally we had it set at like 7 or 8, then I would turn it down to 3 or 4 in order to cool it down and stop the heating process and then allow the liquid to cool down and go back inside the capillary tube.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. So it's just a matter of turning the dial down. And the other thing is, much like melting points, when the liquid takes the turn and goes up into the capillary, there's no way to reuse it. You can't get the liquid back out of the capillary tube. So once the liquid takes the turn and goes in the capillary tube, the sample is shot and you need to put another sample in and redo the process in order to measure the boiling point a second time. And just like melting points, we like to do it 2 or 3 times and then check in and average them and see kind of how close we are. So I have you guys come up to me and tell me what boiling point it is that you got. And I tell you whether or not you're within plus or minus 10, plus or minus 5. We like to try to get within plus or minus 5 degrees of the actual boiling point before I let you proceed. So we have you try it a good number of times to kind of practice it and get it down. Any other questions? No? Okay. Well, if you think of any, we can always go back and hit it. But from there, it's on to infrared spectroscopy and looking at IR. Okay, so let's talk infrared spectroscopy for a little bit. We haven't talked about spectroscopy at all to date. So this is called IR, infrared spectroscopy, or sometimes, depending on the instrument, FTIR. So the FTIR is Fourier transform IR. Just means that the type of instrument that is being used to acquire the spectrum is one that uses an interferometer and looks at beat patterns arising from differences in wavelengths, and then uses Fourier transform mathematics on the beat pattern to come up with a line spectrum. And that's the type of FTIR that we have. That's a more modern type of FTIR that uses an interferometer. So our instrument is actually an FTIR. Let's first talk about spectroscopy in general, and let me grab an image that I made yesterday. I'll just grab this whole thing. We'll bring it over into our notes that we're going to use today. Okay, so this is the electromagnetic wavelength spectrum that goes from X-rays to ultraviolet to infrared to radio waves. And what it does nicely is it kind of looks at the different types of spectroscopy and what wavelength they function in and what aspect of molecular structure we're actually probing. So when we go from X-rays, that's very high energy. So we have the high energy. Come on, there we go. And low energy. But we also have increasing wavelength. The lower the energy, the longer the wavelength. The higher the energy, the shorter the wavelength. So we start from X-rays, which we don't use to probe molecular structure unless we're doing X-ray crystallography. Then we're looking at actual bouncing X-rays off of the nucleus. And so we can get structure there. So I guess we can say that we actually do use X-rays. Ultraviolet, in the ultraviolet and visible spectrum, we do what's called UV-Vis spectroscopy. And the UV-Vis spectroscopy you probably did in Chem 1B. That's where we're looking at sometimes absorbances within molecules. And so we're looking at electronic transitions. We are adding energy into the molecule, which is being absorbed by the molecule to promote an electron into a higher energy state. We then record those absorption frequencies, those frequency bands, and that's what we call UV-Vis spectroscopy. So those have to do with electronic transitions. And those are running from about 200 nanometers in the ultraviolet all the way up to about 800 nanometers in the visible, with the visible spectrum being about 430 on up to about 760. 800 is kind of, 760, 800 is the top end of the visible spectrum. And then from ultraviolet to visible, we go into infrared spectroscopy. And as we look at infrared, the band that we deal with in the infrared is about 2.5 micrometers to about 15 micrometers in terms of wavelength. And there, we're dealing with vibrational frequencies within the molecule. So that's a little bit harder to understand. We understand what electronic transitions mean, but what does it mean to look at vibrational frequencies? And then before I start drawing some more, after you go through infrared, then you go into radio frequencies, and there is a band within radio frequencies, which is in the 1 meter to 5 meter range. And that's where we're actually doing nuclear magnetic resonance. That's where we probe nuclear transitions, and we look at the spin state of the nucleus, and we can actually affect the spin state of the nucleus in that 1 meter to 5 meter range. And that's where we look at nuclear magnetic resonance. So these are our three big areas of spectroscopy that we deal with. UV vis spectroscopy, FTIR, and Raman. Raman spectroscopy is related to FTIR. It's just acquired in a slightly different way. And then you've got nuclear transitions and NMR. Those are our big areas. Okay, and wavelength, I had on here that wavelength in micrometers, a micrometer is 1 × 10⁻⁶ meters. And so wave number, we tend to deal not in wavelength, but we tend to deal in wave number. And when I start looking at spectrum, the spectrum is not listed in wavelength, it's listed in wave number, reciprocal centimeters. And reciprocal centimeters would be 1/1 micrometer. And if we convert micrometers into centimeters, for every 1 centimeter, it is 10,000 micrometers. And so what I would do is I would take 1/1 micrometers and multiply it by 10,000 in order to get reciprocal centimeters. I don't traditionally know why they used reciprocal centimeters, but that is the traditional numbers that they use in reciprocal centimeters. Okay, so let's see, what did I want to do here? I wanted to go back, and talk about vibrational frequencies. Molecules act like harmonic oscillators. So if we take something that we say is mass one, and it has a sphere here with a mass and some sort of spring that connects it, and mass two, that this thing can oscillate as a harmonic oscillator with the spring attached. If we pull it down and let it go, it will vibrate with a frequency which is dependent upon the two masses and the gravity with which it's acting against. So with harmonic oscillators, if you put energy into the harmonic oscillator and you match the frequency of the energy such that this thing oscillates, let's say that this is vibration frequency one. If I put energy into this system and the energy that I'm putting in matches that, so this is energy equal to vibrational frequency one, then what will happen is the harmonic oscillation of this object will increase as it absorbs energy. So the energy will be absorbed and the vibration will intensify. There's a really cool video, a physics video, of a bridge back in the Midwest someplace that was a brand new bridge that they had built, and they had a weather event that started early morning with this slow wind, and the wind had the same vibrational frequency as the bridge. And throughout the day, the bridge continued to increase in the vibrational frequencies within the bridge, such that the bridge actually started to ripple like a wave. And eventually by midday, it had absorbed so much energy from this relentless wind that was going through that the bridge actually tore itself apart. And I could probably find it if I searched on YouTube really quickly, but suffice it to say that harmonic oscillators work very large scale. They also work at the molecular scale on the size of molecules, and that there are many different types of vibrational frequencies that we can look at for molecules that are 2-component and 3-component and 4-component and even bigger in terms of the number of atoms that are making up the vibrational frequency. So some simple vibrational frequencies. simple vibrational frequencies are, let me find the images that I want to reproduce for you. They're in plane and out of plane. There we go. So we have symmetric stretching, and we could look at these just in terms of carbon hydrogen, but they're not just related to carbon hydrogen. So any three components can do these types of bendings and stretchings. So we can have a symmetric stretch where the two hydrogens move back and forth at the same time. And this is called a symmetric stretch. We can have an asymmetric stretch so that we can look at the carbon and hydrogen moving asymmetrically. So one hydrogen can move out, the other hydrogen can move in, and this is an asymmetric stretch. We can have stretching frequencies, such as I'm showing here. So we could look at a carbon hydrogen, which has a stretching frequency. But we can also look at things that are bending. So we can have these two sort of scissoring in a way, and we call this bending. And there are many different types of bending as well, such that we can look at, if we go back to the carbon hydrogen idea, in a three component, two hydrogens and a carbon, we can look at these two hydrogens doing what's called scissoring. So this would be a symmetric scissoring. We can look at, and so that is within the plane. So if I think about them sitting within a plane like this, I can also take that carbon and hydrogen, draw it this way, put the two hydrogens this way, and look at the plane that is formed about the system here, that these guys can come out of the plane and basically wag. And that's what this is called, is wagging. Each one of these has its own frequency with which it occurs. For instance, this asymmetric or the symmetric stretching happens like around 2850 reciprocal centimeters. And this is what I was talking about in terms of the units that we use reciprocal centimeters. The asymmetric is 2925 reciprocal centimeters. The scissoring happens at about 1450. And the wagging at about 1250. Then I can also do rocking. So another sort of frequency that we can see is to have both of these guys moving sort of in the same direction like this. This is a rocking within the plane. This happens at about 750 reciprocal centimeters. And then we can have twisting. So if we take the carbon, put the two hydrogens here, the group back and forward, and then we think about this as being in a plane that is kind of this way. One of these can rock out and the other one and go the other direction, and this is called twisting, where the whole thing is actually twisting, and this is about 1250 reciprocal centimeters. Okay, so one of the things here that this shows you, though, is that this carbon-hydrogen stretch, just a CH2 group, has many different frequencies with which it can vibrate, and when we shine light on it of 2850 reciprocal centimeters, we'll get that symmetric stretch, and we will cause that molecule to vibrate in that mode. And what we can do is, if we design the instrument correctly, we can actually shine light on the on the molecule using a monochronometer, and we can look at where the molecule is absorbing light. And where it is absorbing light, those are vibrational frequencies where the molecule is actually absorbing that energy and using it to increase vibrational frequencies. This is actually nothing new. You all have done this before. You just don't realize that you've done it before. You've never done actually infrared spectrophotometry, but what you have done is you've used microwaves. Right in the range in there between infrared and radio is microwaves. And when you use microwaves, of course, you're heating food. And the microwave is tuned specifically to the frequency of water molecules. It causes the water molecule to vibrate in a more intense fashion. And the more motion there is within the molecules, that's translated to heat. So when you use a microwave and you put food in the microwave, you're actually increasing the rotational and the vibrational frequencies of the water molecules. And you're increasing heat in the food by stimulating more motion in the water molecules. It's very much related to infrared spectrophotometry. You're just using a different vibrational frequency tuned specifically to the water molecule, as opposed to looking at the vibrational frequencies of all different functional groups. So that's a little bit about IR. Okay, and how the IR works is a little bit complicated. Okay, so what we have, I'm trying to think about how I want to draw this. I didn't think about this ahead of time. We have a laser, a light source. And the light source goes through a monochronometer. So that shines through a device that is a monochronometer that takes many different wavelengths coming out of the light source and gives me a single wavelength. The single wavelength then hits a mirror, and the mirror has a hole in the mirror, which is kind of a cool little design, and it literally is a mirror with a hole in the center. And what happens is the light beam is sufficiently large that some of the light makes it through and some of the light is deviated. And the light that makes it through is then passed through another mirror in order to make things nice and tidy inside the instrument, and passes it through a sample. So here we would have a little window. And we'll say that inside this window, we have our sample sitting in here. And some of the light then gets absorbed and less light makes it through. What we do is these two light beams then go into a detector where they are measured against each other. And we look to see how the light has changed and what frequency of light is missing. This is where it uses the interferometer, and that's the part that, That's the part that I'm not as confident in explaining how the interferometer actually works. But the interferometer is basically an instrument that measures two light beams and looks to see how their frequencies are identical or different, such that if there is a small frequency that is missing in one from the other, there will be an interference pattern that arises from the difference in the two light beams. And that interference pattern can tell you exactly what frequency is missing. And that's the job of the interferometer. And it measures how much of it is missing in its intensity. So this then goes through the interferometer. And from that, we then go out to a printout, or out to the screen. And the interferometer tells us what wavelength of light is actually missing. And what we get that comes out of this is a graph that has wave numbers on its bottom. And the wave numbers run from 4,000 reciprocal centimeters on down to usually about 650 reciprocal centimeters, depending upon what type of window material you're actually using. And we have percent transmittance on the y-axis. And the graphs usually run from up to 100% transmittance, all the light coming through, on down to 0%. And we see a graph that that has all of these different frequencies at which the molecule is absorbing. And so that these here would be an absorbance band. And we would read the wave number at which that absorbance band happens. And there are many of them throughout here indicating different vibrational frequencies within the molecule. And what we use is we use tables that relate the functional group and the structural component to the different types of vibrational frequencies. And we just read out kind of what functional groups that molecule has. Certain bands are more important than others. When we go up and we look at these carbon hydrogen stretches and scissoring and wagging, what we notice is that for just a CH2 group, we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 different frequencies for a CH2 group. And every carbon, every hydrocarbon molecule, every organic molecule has CH2 groups, has carbon groups within it. And so they're going to have all of these vibrational frequencies. These would not be very important vibrational frequencies to observe. But what it also goes to show you is that for any even simple molecule, there are many, many vibrational frequencies. And so there are ranges within this 4,000 down to 650 reciprocal centimeters that are important to look at, and others that are not important to look at. And it's our job to learn sort of where do we actually look and where do we put most of our effort into understanding different vibrational frequencies. And the problem is that when most people teach FTIR, they pass out a table to the class that has a huge number of vibrational frequencies. And students don't know what to pay attention to. And they have all these esoteric functional groups that are on these tables, most of which your molecule is never going to have. And students can sit there all day and try to analyze an FTIR and get nowhere because they don't know what to look at and what's important and what's not important. So instead, I sort of take a different approach to FTIR. What I like to do is focus on a very few regions in the FTIR and try to learn those. And then as we go on within the class and we get into the lecture component and we start looking at spectroscopy within the lecture component where we look at NMR, FTIR, mass spec, and putting those three together, then we expand a little bit in the FTIR and start to look at some different frequencies and sort of expand our understanding of functional groups a little bit, but not much, because really most of those things are really not all that important unless that's all you're going to do in terms of being a chemist. If all you're going to do is focus on IR and NMR and spectroscopy, and that is your area of expertise, then by all means, yeah, you're going to spend days, weeks, months analyzing spectra, and you're going to get to understand all of these other little functional groups. But for an organic chemistry student, you don't need that. There's really only three regions that are really important within the FTIR. So the next two goals that we have is to, number one, understand how to prep the sample, and number two, how to read the sample that comes out of it. So those are the two goals. Let me see where I want to start. Let's start, since we're already here and analyzing and talking about the spectrum. No, let's do it in sequence. Let's do sample prep first. Let's talk about how the sample is prepped, because that's fairly short anyway. So let me go grab, unless there's any questions, let me stop for questions for a second. Nobody's putting anything in the chat. Nobody's asking anything. You guys are just letting me ramble.
I had a question.
Yeah, go for it.
For with the light source, the little device you drew up there.
Yeah.
It shows that, it says that a single wavelength makes it through.
Yeah. But
in the chart, it shows a range.
Yeah, so it scans. So the monochronometer is a scanning monochronometer. Basically, what it is a slit that is moved across the light source, which allows in different wavelengths of light. And so when you run a spectrum, it takes time for the spectrophotometer to run the spectrum for two reasons. Number one, it acquires a number of full scans through the entire wavelength. Number two, it has to scan through the wavelength, and it usually scans in batches of two reciprocal centimeters, I think, is the finest that it goes down to. And so the monochronometer, while we say monochronometer in single wavelength, really what it's doing is it's taking two reciprocal centimeter wavelength chunks and allowing those through and measuring those through the interferometer at a time, recording at each wavelength what it's seeing. And so it takes time for the monochronometer to scan through that. And then it starts over and it does that scan again. And it repeats that scan between 16 and 32 times, whatever it is you set the instrument at. It can repeat it as many times as you want, but I find that our spectrophotometer is high enough sensitivity that within 16 scans, we get a beautiful spectrum. So that's a little bit about that monochronometer.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. Any other questions? No? All right, let me go grab another picture that I spent some time drawing. I've gotten used to starting to draw some of these things that I want to put into the notes. And that's not what I wanted to do. And drawing them ahead of time because, well, they're complicated. And I don't think you want to sit around and watch me draw things all day. So this just makes it a little bit easier. Okay. There are many different types of devices and holders for doing spectrophotometry. And this is what ours looks like. So ours is a fairly large plate, and it is two metal plates. There's a base plate and a top plate. And they're just made out of stainless steel. The bottom plate has four studs, which are threaded studs that poke up from the plate that are affixed to it. And then in order, what we do is we take, and let me get a bigger pointer. We take a rubber washer. So this thing is just a piece of black rubber. And we put that rubber washer down to protect what is called a sodium chloride plate. So these sodium chloride plates, that's this piece that's here, the sodium chloride plate literally is a single crystal of sodium chloride that has been cut and highly polished so that it looks like a piece of glass, but it's table salt. And if you get water on it, it dissolves. If you drop it, it breaks. They're about $50 a plate. And so if you crack a plate, we're up $50, no way to repair it. You can't glue it back together. If you wash it with water or put a wet sample on it, it dissolves it, puts a divot in it, and it's very, very difficult to polish the divots back out. They come perfectly, beautifully polished, and they look like a piece of glass when you look at them. They're really cool. And these are pretty much to size, although I know your screen size is probably different than mine, but what I'm looking at in terms of my drawing is that those pieces are probably about an inch by maybe 2 inches in terms of their size. And they're usually about I don't know, maybe 10 millimeters tall, thick, and optically beautiful. They're just optically clear. The reason that we use sodium chloride is because sodium chloride is ionic, and the frequency range that we are scanning from 4,000 reciprocal centimeters down to about 650 reciprocal centimeters, that's covalent bonds. That is where covalent bonds are absorbing energy. And because these are ionic bonds, they're out of that range. So this literally is a window that is transparent to the IR range that we are interested in scanning. And the IR light just passes right through this and is not absorbed at all by the sodium chloride. So that's the difference. That's why we need to use something which is ionic for a window material versus using something that would be a polymer that we might use, some type of plastic polymer that wouldn't break. And sodium chloride tends to be the cheapest of the different window materials that you can use. There are many, many different types of window materials. Sometimes they use strontium chloride. Sometimes they use potassium chloride. There are silver chloride cells. There are all different cells that have different window ranges for which they are good to work within. And sodium chloride runs from about 4,000 on down to 650 and is perfect for organic materials. We put a single drop of the liquid on the plate, and we just use a pipette without a dropper. And we use that little thumb technique that I had talked about before, about applying your thumb pressure to the top of a pipette, and it pushes out a single drop. The single drop sits on the sodium chloride plate, and then we drop the second plate on top of it, and it makes a very thin sandwich, essentially. We get a very thin layer of the liquid that is stuck between the two plates. Put another rubber washer down. The rubber washers are to protect the plates from when we put the metal plates on top of them and put a little bit of pressure on top of these with the nuts. And we don't want that pressure to break the sodium chloride plates. And so the rubber washers sort of cushion that a little bit. So we get a rubber washer on each side. Then we put the top plate on, and then we put these nuts on, and we tighten the nuts just very lightly, very finger tight, and we tighten them kitty corner so that we tighten, if I were to tighten these down, I would tighten number one and number one, and then number two, and number two is sitting over here. So I tighten two at a time, kitty corner. And the reason that I do that is I don't want to tighten one of them and not tighten the other three, because it will rack the entire thing, put too much pressure on one corner and crack the sodium chloride plates in half. So what you do is you tighten two corners at a time, bringing the entire plate down evenly, and then you turn and you tighten the other two corners. When we release the same way. We release one corner, two kitty corners, and then we release the other two kitty corners. It's a lot like putting on a tire. If you've ever changed a tire on an automobile, and they tell you that when you tighten a tire, what you want to do is you want to start in one location and then bounce diagonally across the tire to the other one so that the tire goes on flat up against the wheel. And then you go to the next side and across and over here and across. And you're constantly moving across so that you're trying to tighten those two plates as flat as you can together. Same concept here in the way that we want to tighten them together. And a single drop of liquid, because the liquid, if you put too thick a layer of liquid on it, you're going to get two strong absorbances in your IR, and you're not going to get a good IR scan. So we need just a very thin layer of liquid, one drop on the plate, sandwich the two plates, put the rubber washers on, and then put the retaining nuts on it. And you just snug the retaining nuts enough so that when you pick up the whole device, it doesn't move. That device then goes into a slot inside the instrument. And that is the sample chamber where the light then just passes through that and passes through the window and is then fed into the mirror that redirects it back to the detector, and we get the scan. So sample preparation is super easy. Cleaning these, what we do is when we take them apart and we get the sodium chloride plates, the way that we clean it, let's see if I can grab this, is we use acetone. So let's say that this plate is going to be cleaned. What we do is we use a bottle of acetone. not drawn to scale. This has the little spray nozzle on the end of it. This is acetone. And in the bottom of it, what we have is sodium chloride sitting in the bottom of it. So this is acetone that is saturated with sodium chloride. We use acetone saturated with sodium chloride. You say sodium chloride doesn't dissolve in acetone. Well, remember the solubility experiment where we used a dye molecule that was not soluble in methanol, and yet the methanol entirely changed color, and it got sort of pink from the dye material dissolving into it, even though they were completely non-soluble. Acetone absolutely does dissolve a little bit of sodium chloride. It's not very much. It's a little bit, but it does. When we saturate it with sodium chloride, then the sodium chloride is in dynamic equilibrium, so that if I have a salt crystal, and this is sodium chloride, and this is my solution up above, then the sodium chloride, which is dissolved, and it's not aqueous, but it's in solution, and the sodium chloride, which is a solid, these are in dynamic equilibrium such that every sodium chloride that dissolves, another one precipitates, and therefore the size or mass of the cube never changes. So what we do is we add a little bit of sodium chloride onto this plate. It pools around on the plate, and then we use a very soft chem wipe, a very soft tissue, to wipe off that surface and to repolish the surface a little bit and wipe off any chemical that might, any chemical residue that was left on there from the sample that we had applied. So then, so we add acetone and wipe off with chem wipe. And the chem wipe is a very soft sort of tissue, almost like a lens tissue that we can clean that with. It is non-scratching and won't scratch the plate. Then you let the plate dry. You make sure that all the acetone has evaporated off of it before you hand off the plates to the next person, so that acetone being an organic molecule, if there's any acetone residue on the plate, when the next person puts their sample on, they'll also get acetone come out in their spectrum. So you have to make sure that the acetone actually does not get on the plate itself or does not stay on the plate. And that's just a matter of letting it dry for about a minute, maybe a minute and a half before the next person goes, because acetone evaporates really quickly. So that's how we clean the plates. We never clean the plates with water. You need to be really careful that when you handle the plates, you only handle the plates on the edges of the plate with your hands, because your hands have moisture on them, your hands have water on them. So you never want to touch the face of the plate with your fingers, and you don't want to lick the plate. So actually, I had a student one time, I always say it's like a big salt lick, but don't lick the plate, right? So when I'm demoing this, I take all of the old sodium chloride plates, ones that are broken, ones that are scratched up, ones that we don't use anymore, and I pass them around so that you guys can hold them and look at them. And then I take a brand new one and I show you a brand new one, which I don't pass around. I just kind of like hand it and hold it and walk around and show everybody what a brand new one looks like. And what I always say is, don't lick the plates. And I turn around and some dude is licking the plate because he wanted to see what it tasted like. That it was really sodium chloride. But it's the old plate. It's the ones that have been used for years that have all kinds of crud on them. And it was like a Darwin Award. I couldn't believe that somebody was actually going to lick the plate. I don't know what to say about that. Anyway, don't lick the plates. Okay. How are we doing so far? Everybody with me so far?
Yep.
Okay. So the next thing is understanding the spectrophotometry and looking at the ranges that we look at within IR. Usually what I do at this point is to, let me go back and grab an image. It's this thing. This is one of the, I don't know if I'm going to be able to grab this and copy it or if I'm going to have to import it. I think I'm going to have to import it again. I don't think I can copy it. Let's try it. Oh, it did. That's cool. No. Trying to get it sized is the harder part, apparently. All right, let's leave it there. This is an image that I took from online. And what it does in a cartoon sense is it talks about the different wavelengths that are important wavelengths. And it says that there are wavelengths which are or have great interpretive power. And then there are wavelengths that have less interpretive power, wimpy interpretive power. And I've only ever seen this expressed by this one website. And it was perfect because this was always the way that I've taught it. And it hits just the wavelengths that I want to hit without going through a whole ton of bands. So so let me think about how it says an IR band of this shape and this size, probably that functional group, it's saying an observation and an inference of what that functional group is in the first thing there. But all IR bands are equal, but some are more equal than others. In other words, what it's trying to say is that there are some ranges for which you can look at the range in the spectrophotometer and you can tell, yes, that signal is given rise by a very specific type of functional group. And then there are other areas where an individual frequency could have been given rise by 5, 10, 15 different functional groups. And knowing which functional group gave rise to it is impossible to tell by looking at the spectrum. And so in certain areas, because so many functional groups can give rise to that signal becomes worthless because we can't attribute it to a specific functional group. Whereas in other areas, in a certain band, only one functional group will give rise to that signal. And so if that signal is there, you know the functional group is there. If the signal is not there, you know the functional group is not in your molecule. That's what we're talking about. And that's what we mean by interpretive power. Interpretive power means that only one functional group gives rise to that signal in that area. And so if you have the signal, you know you have the functional group. If you don't, you know you don't have the functional group. In other areas, just not that important. So here's an example of a table that they have alkene, alkyne, aromatic, aldehydes, ketones, carboxylic acids, and they just have all these signals that happen in this chart. And instead, let's arrange them by their interpretive power rather than by their frequency. So rather than just looking at frequencies, what we're going to do is focus on interpretive power. So that's what this chart is that at the top of this chart, we have things that have great interpretive power. And then we go towards things that have slightly less. And as we go down the chart, we're decreasing in terms of our interpretive power of what it is we're actually looking at. And these are the four groups, and usually really three of these groups are what I say are most important. So the most important range, or the easiest range to start with, is the 3400 to 3200 range. 34 to 3200 is what we call the OH range, OH and NH. These are protic hydrogens. So these are either OH or NH, depending upon their shape and their size. And it's really easy to see because it is a very broad peak that shows up and a very intense peak that shows up. And because it only relates to OHs and NHs, and depending upon its shape, it's easy to tell what type of OH or what type of NH you actually have. So over on the right-hand side, and they make fun of this in terms of, you know, application froze up, hang on, restart. Restarts quickly. That's really nice. Okay. the image, the way the image looks, tells you about what type of functional group it is. So if it is a smooth, intense peak, so this one here is smooth and intense. Intense meaning how deep the peak is, how strong the peak is. This is telling me that it's a hydroxyl group. If the peak is weak and sharp and has this pattern to it that is two sort of like fangs, then it's a primary amine that has two NHs on it. If it's weak and single and sharp, then it is either an alkyne or a secondary amine with just one hydrogen on it. The alkyne sort of happens in a slightly different area, so it's not too hard to mistake. And I'm gonna actually go look at some spectrums, and I'm gonna try to use the computer to go look at some different FTIRs and talk about what these shapes actually look like in terms of the FTIR. So we'll get to that in a minute. And then the next one, this one is jagged and usually fairly strong. And it looks like the hairy beard, and that's a carboxylic acid. And so based on the different shapes that we see, we can tell sort of what type of structure is actually there. So let me just take that for a second and draw a spectrum and show you what these differences might look like. So in our spectrum, I'll just sort of mock out what an alcohol looks like. Okay, so this is our percent transmittance. This is 100% and 0%. As we go down to 0%, the lower percent transmittance means that more material has been absorbed. And this is our 4,000 reciprocal centimeters that we started at, out to, let's say 6,500 or 650 reciprocal centimeters. This peak would be centered right around 3,500. A strong peak. Strong usually means somewhere in the range of 0 to 20% transmittance. A medium peak is usually somewhere between 20% on up to maybe 70% transmittance. And a weak is somewhere between 70% and 100%. Well, 100% would be no transmittance, but you get the idea. So that's how we intensify them. And then we also categorize them as being broad or sharp. So we can have broad peaks or sharp peaks. This spectrum with this broad peak and strong is characteristic of an alcohol. And it is the hydroxyl stretch that we are actually observing. What happens is most of the peaks, when we talk about a vibrational frequency, most of the time we are talking about a single frequency, not a broad range. But what happens with hydroxyl groups is that hydroxyl groups do hydrogen bonding. And because a hydroxyl group does hydrogen bonding, what that means is that wherever there is a hydrogen bond, I get differences in bond lengths. And because I get variations within bond lengths, I get different frequencies at which the OH vibrates. All those different frequencies add up to give me a single frequency. So I can think about these as being all these different frequencies which are making up this curve and adding together, each one of them being due to a different vibrational frequency caused because of the hydrogen bonding. They all combine together to make that great big broad swoopy thing, and that swoopy thing indicates that I have a hydroxyl group that is in the molecule. It can't tell me where the hydroxyl group is in the molecule. All it can tell me is that the molecule happens to have a hydroxyl group in it. That's all it can really tell me. So that's the shape of the hydroxyl group. The other shapes that we were recognizing that were NHs, well, let me do the carboxylic acid first, and then I'll hit the other things. So a carboxylic acid, if I take, that did not work. I'm gonna try to do some straighter lines rather than just my little wimpy lines. Okay, carboxylic acids tend to look more jagged. Okay, so this one, percent transmittance, 4,000 on down to 650. Carboxylic acids tend to dimerize. Dimer being two. And they dimerize in their hydrogen bonding ability. Rather than forming networks, the dimer has fewer vibrational frequencies. And because it has fewer vibrational frequencies, the peaks start to come through. And so this is the hydroxyl group from the carboxylic acid. These are the stretches that have less vibrational frequencies in them than hydroxyl groups and tend to be more jagged, although still rather intense in their shape. And so they're very easy to pick out. They're also centered close to 3,500. And so that area there tells you whether you have a hydroxyl, whether you have a carboxylic acid. And then the amines, when we look at an amine and we had the primary amine and we had the secondary amine, the way that the amines look is that they have a much smaller, and then we got all this stuff out here. I tend to just cartoon the other end of it. This would be an NH2, and would be due to an amine. These tend to be weak signals. So they're easily distinguishable from the strong, intense hydroxyl groups, both the smooth, swoopy sort of hydroxyl and the jagged beard from the carboxylic acid. The amines tend to be very weak in their shape. And so also I could have just a single amine that would be there. This would be due to an RNH, two R groups on it. So we have a primary amine and a secondary amine. They're both weak signals. And this area that I keep reproducing that is here, I've reproduced it in all of these, and I keep drawing the same little structure right next to everything. That's where the carbon hydrogen stretch is. And every molecule, every organic molecule has carbon hydrogen in it. So they all have that carbon hydrogen stretch, which is why I kind of look at that and draw that and keep reproducing that, even though it's not critically important to look at. Okay, so we understand where the hydroxyl group shows up at and what it looks like, and these NHs and where they show up at. The next range that we like to look at is the range that is around 1700. So 1700 reciprocal centimeters is a carbonyl group. So if we go back up to that chart, let me go find my chart. The next group that was here, so this was OH, carboxylic acids, NH, that was that range. And that's around the 3,500 reciprocal centimeters. Then around the 1,700 reciprocal centimeters, this is the carbonyl group. And what you can see is that different carbonyl groups will show up at different frequencies. So they have acid chlorides, anhydrides, esters, aldehydes, ketones, acids, amides. There are a tremendous number of different types of functional groups that have carbonyls as part of their structure. And all those carbonyls come at different frequencies. When we get a carbonyl, we consult a table and we see what type of carbonyl it is. But what's great is that very quickly by looking at the IR, you can tell whether or not you have a carbonyl or not. And then we can go to the table and we can consider what type of carbonyl it is. So this happens in the 1700 range. So going back to a chart and looking at carbonyl groups, what I can do is take and let's just do one chart here now that has this range that is sort of my 3500 range, centered over 3500, and then this range centered over 1700, which is a narrower range. This is OHs and carboxylic acids and NH. Over here, this is carbonyls. These two tend to be strong, and this one weak. This is usually very strong, and if it happens to be there, it's usually the most intense peak in the spectrum in terms of how sharp it is. It's also very strong, it's also very sharp. So it's a very easy range to pick out. And then to the right of this, this is what we call the fingerprint range. There are so many frequencies that happen in the fingerprint range that we use it as a fingerprint rather than trying to find individual individual functional groups. So these are really the two functional groups that I look for, hydroxyls and carbonyls, and then the fingerprint range. If we go back to the chart for a second, they had a couple of other things. They have the 2200 reciprocal centimeters, which finds triple bonds, carbon-carbon, triple bond carbon-nitrogen. I tend to ignore these. I find that these triple bonds are not that frequent within organic molecules. And while they're a very easy line to pick out because of the frequency that they happen at, that it's 2200 reciprocal centimeters, I just find it not all that useful. And then lastly, what they have are the cis-trans and different types of aromatic functional groups, whether they're mono, ortho, meta, para, substitution patterns on an aromatic ring. I almost don't use those at all. So I really stick up within these first two, alcohols, carboxylic acids, amides, and carbonyls, and then I use the rest of it as a fingerprint. And that's kind of where I start off at. Okay. How are you guys doing? I'm wondering if we want to take some time and actually look at some spectra. Let me see if I can find spectra for us to look at. I'm going to stop screen sharing my iPad and start screen sharing on my computer. So let me see if I can make that happen. We'll stop the video there so that's not distracting. And we'll come over here and we'll start screen sharing here. Okay. So there is one website that is really, really good. And I can never remember the name of it. I always have to search for it. I find it by going to Japan Spectroscopy Database. I should just bookmark it, but I don't. AIST or SDBS Spectral Database. This is a spectral database which is out of an institute in Japan. And it's a great spectral database, and it's freely available so that anybody can use it. And it has all different types of spectroscopy. You have to agree to their disclaimer, And then it's a little funky in its interface and how you use it. But what we're going to do is we're going to search by compound name. And the first one that I want to find is, let's do isopropanol. Let's see what it finds for us. Probably give us 2-propanol, 1-amino-2-propanol. No, it didn't come up. All right, can't use the back button. If you use the back button, it dumps you back out. So I want a longer alcohol. No, that should work. There's 2-butanol. There's 1-butanol. Okay, and here is the IR. What you can see in this IR immediately is the hydroxyl group that is centered around 3,500. So here's 4,000, 3,000, 3,500 is here. We're a little bit after the 3,500, but pretty darn close. This shape indicates to me immediately that this molecule is an alcohol. And I don't know what's going on in the rest of the molecule over here. I don't know what other functional groups these are, but this is the fingerprint region. This is non-important. But we have the hydroxyl group that is here. And then right next to it, we have the carbon-hydrogen stretches. And because this molecule is a fairly long carbon-hydrogen chain as compared to just the hydroxyl group, it has a fairly intense carbon-hydrogen shape to it here. So we have the OH and we have the CH2 groups and then the fingerprint region. And around 1700, so here's 15, 16, 17, where the carbonyl would show up, we're at baseline. There's nothing in the 1700 range. So this is, just by that shape alone, I would know that this is an alcohol. So we can go back to that. Nope, don't hit back, cancel, don't do that. Return to results. Let's grab another alcohol out of this list. There was 2-butanol. We'll look at its IR. Again, here's the swoopiness of this. This sharp guy that's out here, I'm not exactly sure. This might be due to the matrix that they're in, or it might be a non-hydrogen bonding group. But we should usually just see just the 1-hydroxyl, the carbon-hydrogen stretch, and then the fingerprint region. Let's see if they've done it in liquid form. There we go. I was probably looking at the CCl4 one. So this one is more what I would expect. Sometimes they do these in different matrices. When they say liquid film, they mean like on sodium chloride plates. When they do CCl4 solution, that's probably when I get that sharp peak, and that's from the carbon tetrachloride. So they did it in a solution, put the solution on a plate, allowed the carbon tetrachloride to evaporate, and then ran the spectrum. And then they blank out certain areas where the carbon tetrachloride would absorb strongly. So that's why that was due to that. But the liquid film one, that's going to be more appropriate to what our type of instrument is going to do. So you can get to see this hydroxyl sort of look to it. Let's return to search. And let me grab a carboxylic acid, acetic acid. So here's acetic acid, here's our IR. We'll make sure that we're in the liquid film. And there you can see the jaggedness of this, where it's not perfectly smooth like a hydroxyl group. It's got some structure in it. This one a little less structure than many of them that I see. But they have the same sort of intensity that a hydroxyl has, but the jaggedness. They also have a 1700. Why would they have a 1700? Well, when you think about the shape of this, it has a carbonyl as well as a hydroxyl. So carboxylic acids have both a 1700 peak and they have the hydroxyl peak, but the jagged sort of jagged beard hydroxyl peak shape to them. So that's a carboxylic acid. Let's return to results, see if there's another carboxylic acid that we could grab. Let me ask it for, let me go back to search. And let me grab, benzoic acid. And again, we'll make sure that we're in KBR disk. Yeah, so here you can see the jaggedness. This is more jagged. This is what I really think about. When I think about a carboxylic acid, I really think about this true jaggedness. Still a pretty intense peak, And you can see the sharpness of the 1700, which is telling you the carbonyl that is there. So that's the carbonyl peak. Let's compare this to an amine. Let's go see if I can find an amine really quick. And let's do, butylamine. See what comes up. Secbutylamine, tertbutylamine, butylamine, IR. And again, we'll make sure that we're in the liquid film. Here is the double peak. Usually I find them weaker than this. This is a pretty intense one for an amine, but this has just the two peaks and then the carbon hydrogen stretch and no 1700. So the 1700 would have been in here. Here's 15, 16, 17. This is too far to the right of 1700. The numbers are down in here. So based on how intense that peak is, that's about 45%. That 45% is 15, looks like 1579. I might be off on that a little bit. That might be the 1606, might be 1606. That's what that peak there is. And that's not a carbonyl. And it's also too broad for a carbonyl. So we're into the fingerprint region. But there you can see the primary amine with two hydrogens on it and how it makes the two fangs. So they're pretty easy to pick out the differences between a carboxylic acid, an alcohol, and an amine. Let's go back and look at something that's got a ketone in it or an aldehyde. Benzaldehyde. No, not benzaldehyde. That would be not a good one. Benzophenone. And we want KBR disc. So here's benzophenone. Notice the absence of any hydroxyl. A little bit of shape there, maybe from a little bit of water that's in it or a little bit of enol content, but very little of that. So no real hydroxyl. Carbon hydrogen stretch is here. But then we get this really sharp, and this peak is going down almost to 90 some odd percent. We can find it in the table here. It's going down to 6%. This is 1666 or 1655. That is the carbonyl, which is from this component of the structure right here. So I can tell immediately that whatever this compound happens to be, it's got a carbonyl in it. And then what I can do is I can go back to my table and I can look at the different types of carbonyls and compare it to a table. And there are great tables in the back of Pavia. And you can use the table in the back of Pavia that would tell you what type of carbonyl this happens to be based on its specific wavelength. So that's where I get an idea. And then the rest of this, fingerprint. I don't even try to sit down and figure out all the rest of this. So I'm really looking at two peaks and you say, oh my God, why would I just look at two peaks when I have all of this structural information? Because you can spend weeks trying to figure out what every one of these peaks are. And if you look at this molecule, you really have just carbon, hydrogen, aromatic rings, and the carbonyl. And all of these peaks are due to different bending frequencies of carbon, 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 hydrogen, carbon, hydrogen, carbon. And there are sometimes four component bond vibrations. There's just too much structural information that's in there. And so we use it more as a fingerprint rather than trying to actually figure out what individual functional group is really there. So really two very important interpretive areas, the 3500 hydroxyl area and the 1700 carbonyl area. And that's what I really stick to for right now. Those are the biggest interpretive things. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to give you guys some different spectra to look at and see if you can tell me the major functional groups within the spectra. And I can't do it here in this format because everything that I'm going to pull up is going to have images on it, plus you're going to see the name. But I'll develop like a little lab quiz that'll just give you some different different functional groups to look at and to try to interpret. And I'm also going to figure out, I think that there's a way that I can create a quiz where I give you an unknown and you get the boiling point on the unknown, you get the spectrum from the unknown, you can compare it to the lab in Pavia and you can figure out what the unknown is. And I think that we can set up a little quiz like that fairly easily as well. All right, let me stop for a minute and ask you guys if you have any questions in terms of where we're at.
I have a question.
Go for it.
So when you say different types of carbonyls that can be indicated by certain types of spectra, is that just like which R groups are on either side of the carbonyl?
Yes, definitely. So the R groups that are on either side of the carbonyl can be both carbons, in which case it would be a ketone. They could be a carbon and a hydrogen, which would be an aldehyde. They could be a carbon and an oxygen, which would be an ester. All of those are going to have their own particular frequency. And if I go back to the other screen share, which might be hard to do in short notice. Let's see, stop screen sharing, start screen sharing. Because this is the spot where I've got the table. Okay, so in this table, what you can see is that aldehydes show up at the 1725. Ketones show up at, 1715. Esters show up at 1735. And so different functional groups will have their own wavelength at where they show up, still close to the 1700, but they get shifted plus or minus based on electron withdrawing or electron donating groups, which are lengthening or shortening the different bonds that are there that give them their own frequency. And also over here, what's really nice to see is this idea of conjugated versus strained. These guys shift so that if I have conjugation, which means that I have a double bond conjugated, sp2 groups conjugated with the carbonyl, that will shift me towards lower wavelengths or wave numbers. If I have ring strain or conjugation on the oxygen side, it will shift me towards longer wave numbers. And so we can use some of these other structural components to tell where the frequency is going to go a little bit. I don't use that as much. Really, more what I do is I stick with the component here, which is telling me the, that is not what I want. Oh, it is whole. Okay, that was good. Mostly what I do is stick with a table rather than a chart like this. But within Pavia, there are tables that will show you where the different frequencies are. I was going to see if I could show you. Yes. Let me see if I can do this. Maybe not. Got somewhere in here. There it is, camera. Aha. Here's a table on page 879 in Pavia. And in Pavia, what you can see is that for the carbonyls, they have aldehydes, ketones, carboxylic acids, esters, amides, anhydrides, and it has their frequencies. And then it has a little S or MW. The S is for small. The MW for medium to weak. They have the different intensities that are on that list as well. So they give you not only the frequency, but also the intensity. And tables like this are really common. There's all kinds of tables online that that give you the information in slightly different ways. And we just consult a general IR table when we have a frequency that we're interested in trying to figure out. And for right now, I would stick with the carbonyls and with the hydroxyls and not get too tied up into the other things, because the other things all have frequencies that overlap on top of them. These two areas have the most interpretive power, the 3500 and the 1700, because there are no other functional groups that happen to show up in those areas. So that's a little bit about that.
Very cool.
Yeah, okay, so good question. Any other questions? All right, if you guys don't have any other questions, I think the plan is that this was supposed to be a 3-day lab, and we're gonna start clicking through labs pretty quickly if I don't, if I just lecture on them and not do anything else. So I think what we'll do is maybe on Wednesday, we'll do a little problem solving session, and I'll see if I can't put some spectrum up and have us try and figure out what the spectrum goes to and what type of functional group. And if you guys have Pavia at home, then you can use the charts in Pavia. If not, I'll try to find some resources online that we can just print out a table from online, or I could send out a table and then you guys could use it that way, because I know that not everybody has Pavia at home to be able to go through and use that. And we'll do some problem solving sessions next time rather than just a whole big lecture. How's that sounding? All right, cool. I see lots of thumbs up. It's 10:55. We have lectures starting at 11:10. I humbly respect that we all take a break, or request that we all take a break, and then we'll meet back at 11:10 and we'll start up lecture. Sound good? All right. I'll see you guys in what, 20 minutes here, 15, 20 minutes. All right.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Jason.
You're welcome.